The second battle between Matthew and Nathaniel had to do not with war, but with blood. It began innocently enough, with Matthew talking about Nathaniel's relationship to Agatha Wilson and about Sophie's witch parents. "It's imperative that their DNA be analyzed. The baby's too once it's born." Marcus and Miriam nodded, unsurprised. The rest of us were somewhat startled. "Nathaniel and Sophie bring into question your theory, that demonic traits result from unpredictable mutations rather than heredity," I said, thinking aloud. "We have so little data." Matthew eyed Hamish and Nathaniel with the dispassionate gaze of a scientist examining two fresh specimens. "Our current findings might be misleading." "Sophie's case also raises the issue of whether demons are more closely related to witches than we'd thought." Miriam directed her black eyes at the demon's belly. "I've never heard of a witch giving birth to a demon, never mind a demon giving birth to a witch. You think I'm going to hand over Sophie's blood and my child's blood to a bunch of vampires?" Nathaniel looked perilously close to losing control. "Diana isn't the only creature in this room the congregation will want to study, Nathaniel." Matthew's words did nothing to soothe the demon. "Your mother appreciated the danger your family was facing, or she wouldn't have sent you here. One day you might discover your wife and child gone. If you do, it's highly unlikely you'll ever see them again."
"That's enough," Sarah said sharply. "There's no need to threaten him."
"Keep your hands off my family," Nathaniel said, breathing heavily.
"I'm not a danger to them," Matthew said. "The danger comes from the congregation, from the possibility of open hostility between the three species, and, above all, from pretending this isn't happening."
"They'll come for us, Nathaniel. I've seen it."
Sophie's voice was purposeful, and her face had the same sudden sharpness that Agatha Wilson's had back in Oxford.
"Why didn't you tell me?" Nathaniel said. "I started to tell Agatha, but she stopped me and ordered me not to say another word. She was so frightened. Then she gave me Diana's name and the address for the Bishop House."
Sophie's face took on its characteristic fuzzy look.
"I'm glad Matthew's mother is still alive. She'll like my parts. I'll put her face on one of them, and you can have my DNA whenever you want it, Matthew. The baby's too."
Sophie's announcement effectively put an end to Nathaniel's objections. When Matthew had entertained all the questions he was willing to answer, he picked up an envelope that had been sitting unnoticed at his elbow. It was sealed with black wax.
"That leaves one piece of unfinished business."
He stood and held out the letter.
"Hamish, this is for you."
"Oh, no, you don't."
Hamish crossed his arms over his chest.
"Give it to Marcus."
"You may be the ninth knight, but you're also the seneschal of the Knights of Lazarus and my second in command. There's a protocol we must follow," Matthew said, tight-lipped.
"Matthew would know," Marcus muttered. "He's the only Grand Master in the history of the Order who's ever resigned."
"And now I'll be the only Grand Master to have resigned twice," Matthew said, still holding out the envelope.
"The hell with protocol!" Hamish snapped, banging his fist on the table. "Everybody out of this room except Matthew, Marcus, and Nathaniel.
Please," he added as an afterthought.
"Why do we have to leave?" Sarah asked suspiciously. Hamish studied my aunt for a moment.
"You'd better stay too."
The five of them were closeted in the dining room for the rest of the day. Once an exhausted Hamish came out and requested sandwiches. The cookies, he explained, were long gone.
"Is it me, or do you feel like the men sent us out of the room so they could smoke cigars and talk politics?" I asked, trying to distract myself from the meeting in the dining room by flipping through a jarring mix of old movies and afternoon television. Em and Sophie were both knitting, and Miriam was doing a puzzle she'd found in a book promising demonically difficult Sudoku. She chuckled now and then and made a mark in the margins.
"What are you doing, Miriam?" Sophie asked. "Keeping school,"
Miriam said, making another mark on the page.
"What are they talking about? And who's winning?" I asked, envious of her ability to hear the conversation.
"They're planning a war, Diana. As for who's winning, either Matthew or Hamish, it's too close to call," Miriam replied. "Marcus and Nathaniel managed to get in a few good shots, though, and Sarah's holding her own."
It was already dark, and Em and I were making dinner when the meeting broke up. Nathaniel and Sophie were talking quietly in the family room.
"I need to catch up on a few calls," Matthew said after he'd kissed me, his mild tone at odds with his tense face.
Seeing how tired he was, I decided my questions could wait.
"Of course," I said, touching his cheek. "Take your time. Dinner will be in an hour."
Matthew kissed me again, longer and deeper, before going out the back door.
I need a drink, Sarah groaned, heading to the porch to sneak a cigarette.
Matthew was nothing more than a shadow through the haze of Sarah's smoke as he passed through the orchard and headed for the hop barn. Hamish came up behind me, nudging my back and neck with his eyes.
Are you fully recovered? He asked quietly. What do you think? It had been a long day, and Hamish made no effort to hide his disapproval of me. I shook my head.
Hamish's eyes drifted away and mine followed. We both watched as Matthew's white hand streaked through his hair before he disappeared into the barn.
Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night, Hamish said, quoting William Blake. That poem has always reminded me of him.
I rested my knife on the cutting board and faced him. What's on your mind, Hamish?
Are you certain of him, Diana? He asked.
Em wiped her hands on her apron and left the room, giving me a sad look.
Yes.
I met his eyes, trying to make my confidence in Matthew clear. Hamish nodded, unsurprised.
I did wonder if you would take him on, once you knew who he was, who he still is. It would seem you're not afraid to have a tiger by the tail.
Wordlessly, I turned back to the counter and resumed my chopping.
Be careful.
Hamish rested his hand on my forearm, forcing me to look at him.
Matthew won't be the same man where you're going.
Yes, he will. I frowned. My Matthew is going with me. He'll be exactly the same.
No, Hamish said grimly. He won't.
Hamish had known Matthew far longer, and he'd pieced together where we were going based on the contents of that briefcase. I still knew nothing, except that I was headed to a time before 1976 and a place where Matthew had played chess. Hamish joined Sarah outside, and soon two plumes of gray smoke rose into the night sky. Is everything all right in there? I asked Em when she returned from the family room, where Miriam, Marcus, Nathaniel, and Sophie were talking and watching TV.
Yes, she replied. And here?
Just fine. I focused on the apple trees and waited for Matthew to come in from the dark. Chapter 41. The day before Halloween, a fluttery feeling developed in my stomach. Still in bed, I reached for Matthew.
I'm nervous.
He closed the book he was reading and drew me near.
I know. You were nervous before you opened your eyes.
The house was already bustling with activity. Sarah's printer was churning out page after page in the office below. The television was on, and the dryer whined faintly in the distance as it protested under another load of laundry. One sniff told me that Sarah and Em were well into the day's coffee consumption, and down the hall there was the whir of a hairdryer. Are we the last ones up? I made an effort to calm my stomach. I think so, he said with a smile, though there was a shadow of concern in his eyes. Downstairs, Sarah was making eggs to order while Em pulled trays of muffins out of the oven. Nathaniel was methodically plucking one after another from the tin and popping them whole into his mouth.
Where's Hamish? Matthew asked.
In my office, using the printer. Sarah gave him a long look and returned to her pan. Marcus left his Scrabble game and came to the kitchen to take a walk with his father. He grabbed a handful of nuts as he left, sniffing the muffins with a groan of frustrated desire.
What's going on? I asked quietly.
Hamish is being a lawyer, Sophie replied, spreading a thick layer of butter on top of a muffin.
He says there are papers to sign.
Hamish called us into the dining room in the late morning. We straggled in carrying wine glasses and mugs. He looked as though he hadn't slept. Neat stacks of paper were arranged across the table's expanse, along with sticks of black wax and two seals belonging to the Knights of Lazarus, one small, one large. My heart hit my stomach and bounced back into my throat.
Should we sit? Em asked.
She'd brought in a fresh pot of coffee and topped off Hamish's mug.
Thank you, Em, Hamish said gratefully.
Two empty chairs sat officiously at the head of the table. He gestured Matthew and me into them and picked up the first stack of papers.
Yesterday afternoon, we went over a number of practical issues related to the situation in which we now find ourselves.
My heart sped up, and I eyed the seals again.
"A little less loyally, Hamish, if you please," Matthew said, his hand tightening on my back.
Hamish glowered at him and continued.
"Diana and Matthew will time walk as planned on Halloween. Ignore everything else Matthew told you to do."
Hamish took an obvious pleasure in delivering this part of his message.
"We've agreed that it would be best if everyone disappeared for a little while. As of this moment, your old lives are on hold."
Hamish put a document in front of me.
"This is a power of attorney, Diana. It authorizes me, or whoever occupies the position of seneschal, to act legally on your behalf."
The power of attorney gave the abstract idea of time-walking a new sense of finality. Matthew fished a pen from his pocket.
"Here," he said, placing the pen before me.
The pen's nib wasn't used to the angle and pressure of my hand, and it scratched while I put my signature on the line. When I finished, Matthew took it and dropped a warm black blob on the bottom, then reached for his personal seal and pressed it into the wax. Hamish picked up the next stack.
"These letters are for you to sign, too. One informs your conference organizers that you cannot speak in November. The other requests a medical leave for next year. Your physician, one Dr. Marcus Whitmore, has written in support. In the event you haven't returned by April, I'll send your request to Yale."
I read the letters carefully and signed with a shaking hand, relinquishing my life in the 21st century. Hamish braced his hands against the edge of the table. Clearly he was building up to something.
"There is no telling when Diana and Matthew will be back with us."
He didn't use the word if, but it hovered in the room nonetheless.
"Whenever any member of the farm or of the de Clermont family is preparing to take a long journey or drop out of sight for a while, it's my job to make sure their affairs are in order. Diana, you have no will."
"No." My mind was entirely blank. "But I don't have any assets, not even a car."
Hamish straightened.
"That's not entirely true, is it, Matthew?"
"Give it to me," Matthew said reluctantly.
Hamish handed him a thick document. "This was drawn up when I was last in Oxford."
"Before LaPierre," I said, not touching the pages.
Matthew nodded.
"Essentially, it's our marriage agreement. It irrevocably settles a third of my personal assets on you. Even if you were to leave me, these assets would be yours."
It was dated before he'd come home, before we were mated for life by vampire custom.
"I'll never leave you, and I don't want this."
"You don't even know what this is," Matthew said, putting the pages in front of me.
There was too much to absorb. Staggering sums of money, a townhouse on an exclusive square in London, a flat in Paris, a villa outside Rome, the old lodge, a house in Jerusalem, still more houses in cities like Venice and Seville, jets, cars. My mind whirled.
"I have a secure job." I pushed the papers away. "This is completely unnecessary."
"It's yours nonetheless," Matthew said gruffly.
Hamish let me gather my composure before he dropped his next bombshell. "If Sarah were to die, he would inherit this house too, on the condition that it would be Emily's home for as long as she wanted it. And you're Matthew's sole heir, so you do have assets, and I need to know your wishes."
"I'm not going to talk about this."
The memories of Satou and Juliet were still fresh, and death felt all too close. I stood ready to bolt, but Matthew grabbed my hand and held fast.
"You need to do this, mon coeur. We cannot leave it for Marcus and Sarah to sort out."
I sat back down and thought quietly about what to do with the inconceivable fortune and ramshackle farmhouse that might one day be mine. "My estate should be divided equally among our children," I said finally. "And that includes all of Matthew's children, vampire and biological, those he made himself, and any we might have together. They're to have the Bishop House, too, when Em's through with it."
"I'll see to it," Hamish assured me.
The only remaining documents on the table were hidden inside three envelopes. Two bore Matthew's seal. The other had black and silver ribbon wrapped around it, a lump of sealing wax covering the knot. Hanging from the ribbon was a thick black disc, as big as a dessert plate, that bore the impression of the great seal of the Knights of Lazarus.
Finally, we have the Brotherhood to sort out. When Matthew's father founded the Knights of Lazarus, they were known for helping to protect those who could not protect themselves. Though most creatures have forgotten about us, we still exist. And we must continue to do so, even after Matthew is gone. Tomorrow, before Marcus leaves the house, Matthew will officially give up his position in the Order and appoint his son Grand Master. Hamish handed Matthew the two envelopes bearing his personal seal. He then handed the envelope with the larger seal to Nathaniel. Miriam's eyes widened. As soon as Marcus accepts his new position, which he will do immediately, Hamish said, giving Marcus a stern look, he will phone Nathaniel, who has agreed to join the firm as one of the 8 provincial masters. Once Nathaniel breaks the seal on this commission, he'll be a Knight of Lazarus.
You can't keep making demons like Hamish and Nathaniel members of the Brotherhood. How is Nathaniel going to fight?
Miriam sounded aghast. With these, Nathaniel said, wiggling his fingers in the air, I know computers and I can do my part. His voice took on a fierce edge, and he gave Sophie an equally ferocious look. No one is going to do to my wife or daughter what they've done to Diana. There was stunned silence. That's not all. Hamish pulled up a chair and sat down, knitting his fingers together before him. Miriam believes there will be a war. I disagree. This war's already started. Every eye in the room was directed at Hamish. It was clear why people wanted him to play a role in government, and why Matthew had made him his second in command. He was a born leader. In this room, we understand why such a war might be fought. It's about Diana and the appalling lengths the congregation will go to in an effort to understand the power she's inherited. It's about the discovery of Ashmole 782, and our fear that the book's secrets might be lost forever if it falls into the witch's hands. And it's about our common belief that no one has the right to tell two creatures that they cannot love each other, no matter what their species. Hamish surveyed the room to make sure no one's attention had wandered before he continued. It won't be long before the humans are aware of this conflict. They'll be forced to acknowledge that demons, vampires, and witches are among them. When that happens, we'll need to be Sophie's conventicle in fact, not just in name. There will be casualties, hysteria, and confusion. And it will be up to us, the conventicle and the Knights of Lazarus, to help them make sense of it all, and to see to it that the loss of life and destruction are minimal. Isabeau is waiting for you at Set Tool. Matthew's voice was quiet and steady. The castle grounds may be the only territorial boundary other vampires won't dare to cross. Sarah and Emily will try to keep the witches in check. The bishop name should help. And the Knights of Lazarus will protect Sophie and her baby. So we'll scatter, Sarah said, nodding at Matthew. Then reconvene at the de Clermont house, and when we do, we'll figure out how to proceed. Together. Under Marcus's leadership. Matthew raised his half-full wine glass. To Marcus, Nathaniel, and Hamish. Honor and long life.
It's been a long time since I've heard that, Miriam said softly.
Marcus and Nathaniel both shied away from the attention and seemed uncomfortable with their new responsibilities. Hamish merely appeared weary. After toasting the three men, all of whom looked far too young to have to worry about a long life, Em shepherded us into the kitchen for lunch. She laid out a feast on the island, and we milled around the family room, avoiding the moment when we would have to begin our goodbyes. Finally, it was time for Sophie and Nathaniel to depart. Marcus put the couple's few belongings in the trunk of his little blue sports car. Marcus and Nathaniel stood, their two blonde heads close in conversation, while Sophie said goodbye to Sarah and Em. When she was finished, she turned to me. I'd been banished to the keeping room to make sure that no one inadvertently touched me.
This isn't really goodbye, she told me from across the hall.
My third eye opened, and in the winking of the sunlight on the banister, I saw myself enveloped in one of Sophie's fierce hugs. No, I said, surprised and comforted by the vision. Sophie nodded as if she, too, had seen the glimpse of the future.
See? I told you. Maybe the baby will be here when you get back. Remember, you'll be her godmother.
While waiting for Sophie and Nathaniel to say their goodbyes, Matthew and Miriam had positioned all the pumpkins down the driveway.
With a flick of her wrist and a few mumbled words, Sarah lit them. Dusk was still hours away, but Sophie could at least get a sense of what they would look like on Halloween night. She clapped her hands and tore down the steps to fling herself into the arms of Matthew and then Miriam. Her final hug was reserved for Marcus, who exchanged a few quiet words with her before tucking her into the low-slung passenger seat.
"Thanks for the car," Sophie said, admiring the burled wood on the dashboard. "Nathaniel used to drive fast, but he drives like an old lady now on account of the baby."
"No speeding," Matthew said firmly, sounding like a father. "Call us when you get home."
We waved them off. When they were out of sight, Sarah extinguished the pumpkins. Matthew put his arms around me as the remaining family drifted back inside.
"I'm ready for you, Diana," Hamish said, coming out onto the porch. He'd already put on his jacket, prepared to leave for New York before returning to London.
I signed the two copies of the will, and they were witnessed by Em and Sarah. Hamish rolled up one copy and slid it into a metal cylinder. He threaded the ends of the tube with black and silver ribbons and sealed it with wax bearing Matthew's mark. Matthew waited by the black rental car while Hamish said a courteous farewell to Miriam, then kissed Em and Sarah, inviting them to stay with him on their way to set tour.
"Call me if you need anything," he told Sarah, taking her hand and giving it a single squeeze. "You have my numbers." He turned to me.
"Goodbye, Hamish." I returned his kisses, first on one cheek, then the other. "Thank you for all you did to put Matthew's mind at ease."
"Just doing my job," Hamish said with forced cheerfulness. His voice dropped.
"Remember what I told you. There will be no way to call for help if you need it."
"I won't need it," I said. A few minutes later, the car's engine turned over and Hamish, too, was gone, red taillights blinking in the gathering darkness. The house didn't like its new emptiness, and responded by banging furniture around and moaning softly whenever anyone left or entered a room.
"I'll miss them," Em confessed while making dinner.
The house sighed sympathetically. "Go," Sarah said to me, taking the knife out of Em's hand. "Take Matthew to set tour and be back here in time to make the salad."
After much discussion, we'd finally decided to time walk to the night I'd found his copy of Origin. But getting Matthew to set tour was more of a challenge than I'd expected. My arms were so full of stuff to help me steer, one of his pens and two books from his study, that Matthew had to hold on to my waist. Then we got stuck. Invisible hands seemed to hold my foot up, refusing to let me lower it into set tour. The farther back in time we went, the thicker the strands were around my feet, and time clung to Matthew in sturdy, twining vines. At last we made it to Matthew's study. The room was just as we'd left it, with the fire lit and an unlabeled bottle of wine waiting on the table. I dropped the books and the pen on the sofa, shaking with fatigue. "What's wrong?" Matthew asked. It was as if too many pasts were coming together, and it was impossible to wade through them. I was afraid you might let go.
"Nothing felt different to me," Matthew said. "It took a bit longer than before, but I expected that, given the time and distance."
He poured us both some wine, and we discussed the pros and cons of going downstairs. Finally, our desire to see Isabeau and Mart won out. Matthew remembered I'd been wearing my blue sweater. Its high neckline would hide my bandage, so I went upstairs to change. When I came back down, his face broke into a slow, appreciative smile.
"Just as beautiful now as then," he said, kissing me deeply. "Maybe more so."
"Be careful," I warned him with a laugh. "You hadn't decided you loved me yet."
"Oh, I decided," he said, kissing me again. "I just hadn't told you."
The women were sitting right where we expected them to be, Mart with her murder mystery and Isabeau with her newspapers. The conversation might not have been exactly the same, but it didn't seem to matter. The most difficult part of the evening was watching Matthew dance with his mother. The bittersweet expression on his face as he twirled her was new, and he definitely hadn't caught her up in a fierce bear hug when their dance was over. When he invited me to dance, I gave his hand an extra squeeze of sympathy.
"Thank you for this," he whispered in my ear as he whirled me around.
He planted a soft kiss on my neck. That definitely hadn't happened the first time. Matthew brought the evening to a close just as he had before, by announcing that he was taking me to bed. This time, we said goodnight, knowing that it was goodbye. Our return trip was much the same, but less frightening for its familiarity. I didn't panic or lose my concentration when time resisted our passage, focusing intently on the familiar rituals of making dinner in the Bishop House. We were back in plenty of time to make the salad. During dinner, Sarah and Em regaled the vampires with tales of my adventures growing up. When my aunts ran out of stories, Matthew teased Marcus about his disastrous real estate deals in the 19th century, the enormous investments he'd made in new technologies in the 20th century that had never panned out, and his perpetual weakness for red-headed women. "I knew I liked you." Sarah smoothed down her own unruly red mop and poured him more whiskey. Halloween dawned clear and bright. Snow was always a possibility in this neck of the woods, but this year the weather looked encouraging. Matthew and Marcus took a longer walk than usual, and I lingered over tea and coffee with Sarah and Em. When the phone rang, we all jumped. Sarah answered it, and we could tell from her half of the conversation that the call was unexpected. She hung up and joined us at the table in the family room, which was once again big enough to seat all of us. That was Faye. She and Janet are at the Hunters, in their RV. They want to know if we'll join them on their fall trip. They're driving to Arizona, then up to Seattle. "The goddess has been busy," Em said with a smile. The two of them had been trying for days to decide how they would extricate themselves from Madison without setting off a flurry of gossip. "I guess that settles it. We'll hit the road, then go meet Isabeau." We carried bags of food and other supplies to Sarah's beat-up old car. When it was fully loaded and you could barely see out the rear-view mirror, they started issuing orders. "The candy's on the counter," Em instructed, "and my costume is hanging on the back of the stillroom door. It will fit you fine. Don't forget the stockings. The kids love the stockings." "I won't forget them," I assured her, "or the hat, though it's perfectly ridiculous." "Of course you'll wear the hat," Sarah said indignantly. "It's tradition. Make sure the fire is out before you leave. Tabitha is fed at 4 o'clock sharp. If she isn't, she'll start barfing." "We've got this covered. You left a list," I said, patting her on the shoulder. "Can you call us at the Hunters? Let us know Miriam and Marcus have left?" Em asked. "Here, take this," Matthew said, handing them his phone with a lopsided smile. "You can call Marcus yourself. There won't be reception where we're going."
"Are you sure?"
Em asked doubtfully. We all thought of Matthew's phone as an extra limb, and it was strange to see it out of his hand. "Absolutely. Most of the data's been erased, but I've left some contact numbers on it for you. If you need anything, anything at all, call someone. If you're worried or something strange happens, get in touch with Isabeau or Hamish. They'll arrange for you to be picked up, no matter where you are." "They have helicopters," I murmured to Em, slipping my arm through hers. Marcus's phone rang. "Nathaniel," he said, looking at the screen. Then he stepped away to finish his call, in a new gesture of privacy, one that was identical to what his father always did. With a sad smile, Matthew watched his son. "Those two will get themselves into all kinds of trouble, but at least Marcus won't feel so alone." "They're fine," Marcus said, turning back to us and disconnecting the phone. He smiled and ran his fingers through his hair in another gesture reminiscent of Matthew. "I should let Hamish know, so I'll say my goodbyes and call him." Em held on to Marcus for a long time, her eyes spilling over. "Call us too," she told him fiercely. "We'll want to know that you're both all right." "Be safe." Sarah's eyes scrunched tight as she gathered him in her arms. "Don't doubt yourself." Miriam's farewell to my aunts was more composed, my own far less so.
"We're very proud of you," Em said, cupping my face in her hands, tears now streaming down her face. "Your parents would be too. Take care of each other."
"We will," I assured her, dashing the tears away. Sarah took my hand in hers. "Listen to your teachers. Whoever they are, don't say no without hearing them out first." I nodded.
You've got more natural talent than any witch I've ever seen. Maybe more than any witch who's lived for many, many years, Sarah continued. I'm glad you're not going to waste it. Magic is a gift, Diana, just like love. She turned to Matthew. I'm trusting you with something precious. Don't disappoint me.
I won't, Sarah, Matthew promised.
She accepted our kisses, then bolted down the steps to the waiting car. Goodbyes are hard for Sarah, Em explained. We'll talk to you tomorrow, Marcus. She climbed into the front seat, waving over her shoulder. The car spluttered to life, bumped its way across the ruts in the driveway, and turned toward town. When we went back into the house, Miriam and Marcus were waiting in the front hall, bags at their feet.
We thought you two should have some time alone, Miriam said, handing her duffel bag to Marcus. And I hate long goodbyes.
She looked around.
Well, she said briskly, heading down the porch stairs. See you when you get back.
After shaking his head at Miriam's retreating figure, Matthew went into the dining room and returned with an envelope.
Take it, he said to Marcus, his voice gruff. I never wanted to be Grandmaster, Marcus said. You think I did? This was my father's dream. Philippe made me promise the Brotherhood wouldn't fall into Baldwin's hands. I'm asking you to do the same.
I promise. Marcus took the envelope. I wish you didn't have to go.
I'm sorry, Marcus. I swallowed the lump in my throat and rested my warm fingers lightly on his cold flesh.
For what?
His smile was bright and true.
For making my father happy?
For putting you in this position and leaving behind such a mess.
I'm not afraid of war, if that's what you mean. It's following along in Matthew's wake that worries me.
Marcus cracked the seal. With that deceptively insignificant snap of wax, he became the Grand Master of the Knights of Lazarus.
Je suis à votre commande, Seigneur, Matthew murmured, his head bowed.
Baldwin had spoken the same words at LaGuardia. They sounded so different when they were sincere.
Then I command you to return and take back the Knights of Lazarus, Marcus said roughly, before I make a complete hash of things. I'm not French, and I'm certainly no knight.
You have more than a drop of French blood in you, and you're the only person I trust to do the job. Besides, you can rely on your famous American charm, and it's possible you might like being Grandmaster in the end.
Marcus snorted and punched the number 8 on his phone.
It's done, he said briefly to the person on the other end. There was a short exchange of words. Thank you.
Nathaniel has accepted his position, Matthew murmured, the corners of his mouth twitching. His French is surprisingly good.
Marcus scowled at his father, walked away to say a few more words to the demon, and returned.
Between father and son, there was a long look, the clasp of hand to elbow, the press of a hand on the back, a pattern of leave-taking based on hundreds of similar farewells. For me, there was a gentle kiss, a murmured, "Be well," and then Marcus, too, was gone. I reached for Matthew's hand. We were alone. Chapter 42
It's just us and the ghosts now.
My stomach rumbled.
What's your favorite food? He asked.
Pizza, I said promptly.
You should have it while you can. Order some and we'll pick it up.
We hadn't been beyond the immediate environs of the Bishop House since our arrival, and it felt strange to be driving around the Greater Madison area in a Range Rover next to a vampire. We took the back way to Hamilton, passing south over the hills into town before swinging north again to get the pizza. During the drive, I pointed out where I'd gone swimming as a child, and where my first real boyfriend had lived. The town was covered with Halloween decorations, black cats, witches on brooms, even trees decorated in orange and black eggs. In this part of the world, it wasn't just the witches who took the celebration seriously. When we arrived at the pizza place, Matthew climbed out with me, seemingly unconcerned that witches or humans might see us. I stretched up to kiss him, and he returned it with a laugh that was almost lighthearted. The college student who rang us up looked at Matthew with obvious admiration when she handed him the pie. Good thing she isn't a witch, I said when we got back into the car.
She would have turned me into a newt and flown off with you on her broomstick.
Fortified with pizza, pepperoni and mushroom, I tackled the mess left in the kitchen and the family room. Matthew brought out handfuls of paper from the dining room and burned them in the kitchen fireplace.
"What do we do with these?" he asked, holding up my mother's letter, the mysterious three-line epigram, and the page from Ashmole 782.
"Leave them in the keeping room," I told him. "The house will take care of them." I continued to putter, doing laundry and straightening up Sarah's office. It wasn't until I went up to put our clothes away that I noticed both computers were missing. I went pounding downstairs in a panic.
"Matthew, the computers are gone."
"Hamish has them," he said, catching me in his arms and smoothing my hair against the back of my head. "It's all right. No one's been in the house." My shoulders sagged, heart still hammering at the idea of being surprised by another Domenico or Juliet. He made tea, then rubbed my feet while I drank it. All the while he talked about nothing important, houses in Hamilton that had reminded him of some other place and time, his first sniff of a tomato, what he thought when he'd seen me row in Oxford, until I relaxed into the warmth and comfort. Matthew was always different when no one else was around, but the contrast was especially marked now that our families had left. Since arriving at the Bishop House, he'd gradually taken on the responsibility for 8 other lives. He'd watched over all of them, regardless of who they were or how they were related to him, with the same ferocious intensity. Now he had only one creature to manage.
"We haven't had much time to just talk," I reflected, thinking of the whirlwind of days since we'd met. "Not just the two of us."
The past weeks have been almost biblical in their tests. I think the only thing we've escaped is a plague of locusts. He paused. "But if the universe does want to test us the old-fashioned way, this counts as the end of our trial. It will be 40 days this evening."
So little time for so much to have happened. I put my empty mug on the table and reached for his hands. "Where are we going, Matthew?"
"Can you wait a little longer, mon coeur?" He looked out the window. "I want this day to last, and it will be dark soon enough." "You like playing house with me." A piece of hair had fallen onto his forehead, and I brushed it back. "I love playing house with you," he said, capturing my hand.
We talked quietly for another half hour before Matthew glanced outdoors again. "Go upstairs and take a bath. Use every drop of water in the tank and take a long hot shower, too. You may crave pizza every now and then in the days to come, but that will be nothing compared to your longing for hot water. In a few weeks, you will cheerfully commit murder for a shower." Matthew brought up my Halloween costume while I bathed, a calf-length black dress with a high neck, sharp-toed boots, and a pointy hat.
"What, may I ask, are these?" He brandished a pair of stockings with red and white horizontal stripes.
"Those are the stockings Em mentioned," I groaned. "She'll know if I don't wear them."
"If I still had my phone, I would take a picture of you in these hideous things and blackmail you for eternity."
"Is there anything that would ensure your silence?"
I sank lower into the tub. "I'm sure there is," Matthew said, tossing the stockings behind him.
We were playful at first. As at dinner last night, and again at breakfast, we carefully avoided mentioning that this might be our last chance to be together. I was still a novice, but Em told me even the most experienced time walkers respected the unpredictability of moving between past and future, and recognized how easy it would be to wander indefinitely within the spiderweb of time. Matthew sensed my changing mood, and answered at first with greater gentleness, then with fierce possessiveness, that demanded I think of nothing but him. Despite our obvious need for comfort and reassurance, we didn't consummate our marriage. "When we're safe," he'd murmured, kissing me along the collarbone, "when there's more time."
Somewhere along the way, my smallpox blister burst. Matthew examined it and pronounced that it was doing nicely, an odd description for an angry open wound the size of a dime. He removed the bandage from my neck, revealing the barest traces of Miriam's sutures, and the one from my arm as well.
"You're a fast healer," he said approvingly, kissing the inside of my elbow where he'd drunk from my veins. His lips felt warm against my skin.
"How odd. My skin is cold there."
I touched my neck.
Here, too.
Matthew drew his thumb across the spot where my carotid artery passed close to the surface. I shivered at his touch. The number of nerve endings there had seemingly tripled. Extra sensitivity, Matthew said, as if you're part vampire. He bent and put his lips against my pulse.
Oh,
I gasped, taken aback at the intensity of feeling. Mindful of the time, I buttoned myself into the black dress. With a braid down my back, I might have stepped out of a photograph from the turn of the 19th century. Too bad we're not time-walking to World War I, Matthew said, pulling at the sleeves of the dress. You'd make a convincing schoolmistress circa 1912 in that get-up. Not with these on. I sat on the bed and started pulling on the candy-striped stockings. Matthew roared with laughter and begged me to put the hat on immediately.
I'll set fire to myself, I protested. Wait until the jack-o'-lanterns are lit.
We went outside with matches, thinking we could light the pumpkins the human way. A breeze had kicked up, though, which made it difficult to strike the matches and impossible to keep the candles illuminated. Damn it, I swore. Sophie's work shouldn't go to waste.
Can you use a spell? Matthew said, already prepared to have another go at the matchbox.
If not, then I have no business even pretending to be a witch on Halloween. The mere thought of explaining my failure to Sophie made me concentrate on the task at hand, and the wick burst into life. I lit the other 11 pumpkins that were scattered down the drive, each more amazing or terrifying than the last. At 6 o'clock, there was a fierce pounding on the door and muffled cries of, "Trick-or-treat!" Matthew had never experienced an American Halloween, and he eagerly greeted our first visitors. Whoever was outside received one of his heart-stopping smiles before Matthew grinned and beckoned me forward. A tiny witch and a slightly larger vampire were holding hands on the front porch.
"Trick-or-treat,"
they intoned, holding out their open pillowcases.
"I'm a vampire,"
the boy said, baring his fangs at Matthew. He pointed to his sister.
"She's a witch."
"I can see that,"
Matthew said gravely, taking in the black cape and white makeup.
"I'm a vampire, too."
The boy examined him critically.
"Your mother should have worked harder on your costume. You don't look like a vampire at all. Where's your cape?"
The miniature vampire swept his arms up, a fold of his own satin cape in each fist, revealing its bat-shaped wings.
"See? You need your cape to fly. Otherwise, you can't turn into a bat."
"Ah, that is a problem. My cape is at home, and now I can't fly back and get it. Perhaps I can borrow yours?"
Matthew dumped a handful of candy into each pillowcase, the eyes of both children growing large at his generosity. I peeked around the door to wave at their parents.
"You can tell she's a witch,"
the girl piped up, nodding approvingly at my red and white striped stockings and black boots. At their parents' urging, they shouted thank yous as they trotted down the walk and climbed into the waiting car. Over the next 3 hours, we greeted a steady stream of fairy princesses, pirates, ghosts, skeletons, mermaids, and space aliens, along with still more witches and vampires. I gently told Matthew that one piece of candy per goblin was de rigueur, and that if he didn't stop distributing handfuls of goodies now, we would run out long before the trick-or-treating stopped at 9 o'clock. It was hard to criticize, however, given his obvious delight. His responses to the children who came to the door revealed a wholly new side of him. Crouching down so that he was less intimidating, he asked questions about their costumes and told every young boy purporting to be a vampire that he was the most frightening creature he'd ever beheld. But it was his encounter with one fairy princess, wearing an oversized set of wings and a gauze skirt, that tugged hardest at my heart. Overwhelmed and exhausted by the occasion, she burst into tears when Matthew asked which piece of candy she wanted. Her brother, a strapping young pirate aged 6, dropped her hand in horror.
"We shall ask your mother."
Matthew swept the fairy princess into his arms and grabbed the pirate by the back of his bandana. He safely delivered both children into the waiting arms of their parents. Long before reaching them, however, the fairy princess had forgotten her tears. Instead, she had one sticky hand wrapped in the collar of Matthew's sweater and was tapping him lightly on the head with her wand, repeating, "Bippity-boppity-boop!"
When she grows up and thinks about Prince Charming, he'll look just like you, I told him after he returned to the house. A shower of silver glitter fell just as he dipped his head for a kiss. You're covered with fairy dust, I said, laughing, and brushing the last of it from his hair. Around 8 o'clock, when the tide of fairy princesses and pirates turned to gothic teenagers wearing black lipstick and leather garments festooned with chains, Matthew handed me the basket of candy and retreated to the keeping room. Coward, I teased, straightening my hat before answering the door to another gloomy bunch. Only 3 minutes before it would be safe to turn out the porch light without ruining the bishop's Halloween reputation, we heard another loud knock and a bellowed, "Trick-or-treat!" Who can that be? I groaned, slamming my hat back on my head. 2 young wizards stood on the front steps. One was the paper boy. He was accompanied by a lanky teenager with bad skin and a pierced nose, whom I recognized dimly as belonging to the O'Neill clan. Their costumes, such as they were, consisted of torn jeans, safety-pinned t-shirts, fake blood, plastic teeth, and lengths of dog leash. "Aren't you a bit old for this, Sammy?"
"It's Sam now."
Sammy's voice was breaking, full of unexpected ups and downs, and his prosthetic fangs gave him a lisp. "Hello, Sam." There were 6 pieces in the bottom of the candy basket. "You're welcome to what's left. We were just about to put out the lights. Shouldn't you be at the hunter's house bobbing for apples?"
"We heard your pumpkins were really cool this year."
Sammy shifted from one foot to the other.
"And, well..."
He flushed and took out his plastic teeth.
"Rob swore he saw a vampire here the other day. I bet him $20 that the bishops wouldn't let one in the house."
"What makes you so sure you'd recognize a vampire if you saw one?" The vampire in question came out of the keeping room and stood behind me. "Gentlemen," he said quietly. 2 adolescent jaws dropped.
"We'd have to be either human or really stupid not to recognize him," said Rob, awestruck. "He's the biggest vampire I've ever seen."
"Cool." Sammy grinned from ear to ear. He high-fived his friend and grabbed the candy. "Don't forget to pay up, Sam," I said sternly. "And
Samuel,"
Matthew said, his French accent unusually pronounced,
"could I ask you, as a favor to me, not to tell anyone else about this?"
"Ever?" Sammy was incredulous at the notion of keeping such a juicy piece of information to himself. Matthew's mouth twitched. "No, I see your point. Can you keep quiet until tomorrow?"
"Sure,"
Sammy nodded, looking to Rob for confirmation. "That's only 3 hours. We can do that, no problem." They got on their bikes and headed off. "The roads are dark," Matthew said with a frown of concern. "We should drive them." "They'll be fine. They're not vampires, but they can definitely find their way to town." The 2 bikes skidded to a halt, sending up a shower of loose gravel.
"You want us to turn off the pumpkins?"
Sammy shouted from the driveway. "If you want to," I said. "Thanks." Rob O'Neill waved at the left side of the driveway, and Sammy at the right, extinguishing all the jack-o'-lanterns with enviable casualness. The 2 boys rode off, their bikes bumping over the ruts, their progress made easier by the moon and the burgeoning 6th sense of the teenage witch. I shut the door and leaned against it, groaning. My feet are killing me. I unlaced my boots and kicked them off, tossing the hat onto the steps. "The page from Ashmole 782 is gone," Matthew announced quietly, leaning against the banister post.
"Mom's letter?"
"Also gone."
"It's time, then."
I pulled myself away from the door, and the house moaned softly. "Make yourself some tea and meet me in the family room. I'll get the bag." He waited for me on the couch, the soft-sided briefcase sitting closed at his feet, and the silver chess piece and gold earring lying on the coffee table. I handed him a glass of wine and sat alongside. "That's the last of the wine." Matthew eyed my tea. "That's the last of the tea for you as well." He ran his hands nervously through his hair and took a deep breath. "I would have liked to go some time closer, when there was less death and disease," he began, sounding tentative. "And somewhere closer, with tea and plumbing. But I think you'll like it once you get used to it."
I still didn't know when or where it was. Matthew bent down to undo the lock. When he opened the bag and saw what was on top, he let out a sigh of relief.
Thank God. I was afraid Isabeau might have sent the wrong one.
You haven't opened the bag yet?
I was amazed at his self-control.
No.
Matthew lifted out a book. I didn't want to think about it too much, just in case.
He handed me the book. It had black leather bindings with simple silver borders. It's beautiful, I said, running my fingers over its surface.
Open it.
Matthew looked anxious. Will I know where we're going once I do? Now that the third object was in my hands, I felt strangely reluctant.
I think so.
The front cover creaked open, and the unmistakable scent of old paper and ink rose in the air. There were no marbled end papers, no book plates, no additional blank sheets such as 18th and 19th century collectors put in their books, and the covers were heavy, indicating that wooden boards were concealed beneath the smoothly stretched leather. Two lines were written in thick black ink on the first page in a tight, spiky script of the late 16th century. "To my own sweet Matt," I read aloud, "whoever loved that loved not at first sight." The dedication was unsigned, but it was familiar.
"Shakespeare?"
I lifted my eyes to Matthew.
"Not originally," he replied, his face tense. "Will was something of a magpie when it came to collecting other people's words."
I slowly turned the page. It wasn't a printed book, but a manuscript, written in the same bold hand as the inscription. I looked closer to make out the words. "Settle thy studies, Faustus, and begin to sound the depth of that thou wilt profess."
"Jesus," I said hoarsely, clapping the book shut. My hands were shaking.
"He'll laugh like a fool when he hears that was your reaction," Matthew commented. "Is this what I think it is?"
"Probably."
"How did you get it?"
"Kit gave it to me."
Matthew touched the cover lightly. "Faustus was always my favorite." Every historian of alchemy knew Christopher Marlowe's play about Dr. Faustus, who sold his soul to the devil in exchange for magical knowledge and power. I opened the book and ran my fingers over the inscription while Matthew continued. "Kit and I were friends, good friends, in a dangerous time when there were few creatures you could trust. We raised a certain amount of hell and eyebrows. When Sophie pulled the chess piece I'd lost to him from her pocket, it seemed clear that England was our destination." The feeling my fingertips detected in the inscription was not friendship, however. This was a lover's dedication.
"Were you in love with him, too?" I asked quietly.
"No," Matthew said shortly. "I loved Kit, but not the way you mean, and not in the way he wanted. Left to Kit, things would have been different. But it wasn't up to him, and we were never more than friends."
"Did he know what you are?"
I hugged the book to my chest like a priceless treasure.
"Yes. We couldn't afford secrets. Besides, he was a demon, and an unusually perceptive one at that. You'll soon discover it's pointless trying to keep anything from Kit."
That Christopher Marlowe was a demon made a certain sense, based on my limited knowledge of him.
"So we're going to England," I said slowly. "When, exactly?"
"To 1590.
"Where?"
"Every year, a group of us met at the Old Lodge for the Catholic holidays of All Saints and All Souls. Few dared to celebrate them, but it made Kit feel daring and dangerous to commemorate them in some way. He would read us his latest draft of Faustus. He was always fiddling with it, never satisfied. We'd drink too much, play chess, and stay awake until dawn." Matthew drew the manuscript from my arms. He rested it on the table and took my hands in his.
"Is this all right with you, mon coeur? We don't have to go. We can think of some time else."
But it was already too late. The historian in me had started to process the opportunities of life in Elizabethan England.
"There are alchemists in England in 1590.
"Yes," he said warily, "none of them particularly pleasant to be around, given the mercury poisoning and their strange work habits. More important, Diana, there were witches. Powerful witches who can guide your magic."
"Will you take me to the playhouses?" Could I keep you from them?
Matthew's brows rose.
Probably not.
My imagination was caught by the prospect opening before us. Can we walk through the Royal Exchange after they light the lamps?
Yes.
He drew me into his arms. And go to St. Paul's to hear a sermon, and to Tyburn for an execution.
We'll even chat about the inmates with the clerk at Bedlam.
His body shook with suppressed laughter. Good Lord, Diana, I'm taking you to a time when there was plague, few comforts, no tea and bad dentistry, and all you can think about is what Gresham's Exchange looked like at night.
I pulled back to look at him with excitement. Will I meet the Queen?
Absolutely not. Matthew pressed me to him with a shudder. The mere thought of what you might say to Elizabeth Tudor and she to you makes my heart falter. Coward, I said for the second time that night.
You wouldn't say so if you knew her better. She eats courtiers for breakfast.
Matthew paused. Besides, there's something else we can do in 1590.
What's that?
Somewhere in 1590, there's an alchemical manuscript that will one day be owned by Elias Ashmole. We might look for it.
The manuscript might be complete then, its magic unbroken.
I extricated myself from his arms and sat back against the cushions, staring in wonder at the three objects on the coffee table.
We're really going to go back in time.
We are. Sarah told me we had to be careful not to take anything modern into the past. Mart made you a smock and me a shirt. Matthew reached into the briefcase again and pulled out two plain linen garments with long sleeves and strings at the neck. She had to sew them by hand and she didn't have much time. They're not fancy, but at least we won't shock whomever we first meet. He shook them out, and a small black velvet bag fell from their linen folds. Matthew frowned. What's this? He said, picking it up. A note was pinned to the outside. He opened it. From Isabeau. This was an anniversary gift from your father. I thought you might like to give it to Diana. It will look old-fashioned, but will suit her hand. The bag held a ring, made of three separate gold bands twisted together. The two outer bands were fashioned into ornate sleeves, colored with enamel and studded with small jewels to resemble embroidery. A golden hand curved out of each sleeve, perfectly executed down to the tiny bones, slender tendons, and minute fingernails. Clasped between the two hands on the inner ring was a huge stone that looked like glass. It was clear and unfaceted, set in a golden bezel, with a black-painted background. No jeweler would put a hunk of glass in a ring so fine. It was a diamond. That belongs in a museum, not on my finger. I was mesmerized by the lifelike hands, and tried not to think about the weight of the stone they held. My mother used to wear it all the time, Matthew said, picking it up between his thumb and index finger. She called it her scribble ring because she could write on glass with the point of the diamond. His keen eye saw some detail of the ring that mine did not. With a twist of the golden hands, the three rings fanned out in his palm. Each band was engraved, the words twining around the flat surfaces. We peered at the tiny writing. They're posies, verses that people wrote as tokens of affection. This one says, "A ma vie de cœur entier?" Matthew said, the tip of his index finger touching the gold surface. It's old French for my whole heart for my whole life. And this? Mon début à mon fin? With an alpha and an omega. My French was good enough to translate that. My beginning and my end. What's on the inner band? It's engraved on both sides. Matthew read the lines, turning the rings over as he did so. Ce souvenir du passé, à qu'il y a un avenir. Remember the past, and that there is a future.
The posies suit us perfectly. It was eerie that Philippe had selected verses for Isabeau so long ago that could have meaning for Matthew and me today.
Vampires are also time-walkers of a sort. Matthew fitted the ring together. He took my left hand and looked away, afraid of my reaction. Will you wear it? I took his chin in my fingers, turning his head toward me, and nodded, quite unable to speak. Matthew's face turned shy, and his eyes dropped to my hand, still in his. He slid the ring over my thumb, so it rested just above the knuckle. With this ring, I thee wed,
and with my body I the honor.
Matthew's voice was quiet, and it shook just a bit. He moved the ring deliberately to my index finger, sliding it down until it met the middle joint.
And with all my worldly goods I thee endow.
The ring skipped over my middle finger and slid home onto the fourth finger of my left hand. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. He raised my hand to his mouth, and his eyes met mine once more, cold lips pressing the ring into my skin. Amen.
Amen, I repeated.
So now we're married in the eyes of vampires and according to church law. The ring felt heavy, but Isabeau was right. It did suit me.
In your eyes, too, I hope.
Matthew sounded uncertain.
Of course we're married in my eyes.
Something of my happiness must have shown, because his answering smile was as broad and heartfelt as any I'd seen.
Let's see if Maman sent more surprises.
He dove back into the briefcase and came up with a few more books. There was another note, also from Isabeau.
These were next to the manuscript you asked for, Matthew read. I sent them too, just in case.
Are they also from 1590?
No, Matthew said, his voice thoughtful. None of them.
He reached into the bag again. When his hand emerged, it was clutching the silver pilgrim's badge from Bethany.
There was no note to explain why it was there.
The clock in the front hall struck 10. We were due to leave. Soon.
I wish I knew why she sent these.
Matthew sounded worried. Maybe she thought we should carry other things that were precious to you? I knew how strong his attachment was to the tiny silver coffin.
Not if it makes it harder for you to concentrate on 1590.
He glanced at the ring on my left hand, and I closed my fingers.
There was no way he was taking it off, whether it was from 1590 or not.
We could call Sarah and ask her what she thinks.
Matthew shook his head. No, let's not trouble her. We know what we need to do. Take 3 objects and nothing else from the past or present that might get in the way. We'll make an exception for the ring, now that it's on your finger.
He opened the top book and froze. What is it?
My annotations are in this book, and I don't remember putting them there.
It's more than 400 years old. Maybe you forgot. In spite of my words, a cold finger ran up my spine. Matthew flipped through a few more pages and inhaled sharply.
If we leave these books in the keeping room, along with the pilgrim's badge, will the house take care of them?
It will if we ask it to, I said. Matthew, what's going on?
I'll tell you later. We should go. These, he said, lifting the books in Lazarus's coffin, need to stay here.
We changed in silence. I took off everything down to my bare skin, shivering as the linen smock slipped over my shoulders. The cuffs skimmed my wrists as it fell to my ankles, and the wide neck drew closed when I tugged on the string. Matthew was out of his clothes and into his shirt quickly. It nearly reached his knees, and his long white legs stuck out below. While I collected our clothes, Matthew went to the dining room and came out with stationery and one of his favorite pens. His hand sped across the page, and he folded the single sheet and tucked it into the waiting envelope.
A note for Sarah, he explained. We'll ask the house to take care of that, too.
We carried the extra books, the note, and the pilgrim's badge to the keeping room. Matthew put them carefully on the sofa.
Shall we leave the lights on? Matthew asked.
No, I said. Just the porch light, in case it's still dark when they come home. There was a smudge of green when we turned off the lamps. It was my grandmother, rocking in her chair. Goodbye, Grandma.
Neither Bridget Bishop nor Elizabeth was with her.
Goodbye, Diana.
The house needs to take care of those. I pointed to the pile of objects on the sofa.
Don't worry about a thing except for where you're going.
Slowly, we walked the length of the house to the back door, shutting off lights as we went. In the family room, Matthew picked up Dr. Faustus, the earring, and the chess piece. I looked around one last time at the familiar brown kitchen. Goodbye, house.
Tabitha heard my voice and ran screeching from the still room. She came to an abrupt halt and stared at us without blinking. Goodbye, ma petite, Matthew said, scooping to scratch her ears.
We'd decided to leave from the hop barn. It was quiet, with no vestiges of modern life to serve as distractions. We moved through the apple orchard and over the frost-covered grass in our bare feet, the cold quickening our steps. When Matthew pulled open the barn door, my breath was visible in the chilly air.
It's freezing.
I drew my smock closer, teeth chattering.
There will be a fire when we arrive at the old lodge, he said, handing me the earring.
I put the thin wire through the hole in my ear and held my hand out for the goddess. Matthew dropped her into my palm.
What else?
Wine, of course. Red wine. Matthew handed me the book and folded me into his arms, planting a firm kiss on my forehead.
Where are your rooms?
I shut my eyes, remembering the old lodge.
Upstairs, on the western side of the courtyard, overlooking the deer park.
And what will it smell like?
Like home, he said. Wood smoke and roasted meat from the servants' dinner, beeswax from the candles, and the lavender used to keep the linens fresh.
Can you hear anything special?
Nothing at all. Just the bells from St. Mary's and St. Michael's, the crackle of the fires and the dogs snoring on the stairs.
How do you feel when you're there? I asked, concentrating on his words and the way they in turn made me feel.
I've always felt ordinary at the old lodge, Matthew said softly. It's a place where I can be myself.
A whiff of lavender swirled through the air, out of time and place in a Madison hop barn in October. I marveled at the scent and thought of my father's note. My eyes were fully open to the possibilities of magic now. What will we do tomorrow?
We'll walk in the park, he said, his voice a murmur and his arms iron bands around my ribs. If the weather's fine, we'll go riding. There won't be much in the gardens this time of year. There must be a lute somewhere. I'll teach you to play if you'd like.
Another scent, spicy and sweet, joined with the lavender, and I saw a tree laden with heavy golden fruit. A hand stretched up, and a diamond winked in the sunlight, but the fruit was out of reach. I felt frustration and the keen edge of desire, and I was reminded of Emily's telling me that magic was in the heart as well as the mind.
Is there a quince in the garden?
Yes, Matthew said, his mouth against my hair. The fruit will be ripe now. The tree dissolved, though the honeyed scent remained. Now I saw a shallow silver dish sitting on a long wooden table. Candles and firelight were reflected in its burnished surface. Piled inside the dish were the bright yellow quinces that were the source of the scent. My fingers flexed on the cover of the book I held in the present, but in my mind they closed on a piece of fruit in the past.
I can smell the quinces.
Our new life in the old lodge was already calling to me.
Remember, don't let go, no matter what.
With the past everywhere around me, the possibility of losing him was all that was frightening.
Never, he said firmly.
And lift up your foot and then put it down again when I tell you.
He chuckled. I love you, Ma Leon. It was an unusual response, but it was enough.
Home, I thought.
My heart tugged with longing. An unfamiliar bell tolled the hour. There was a warm touch of fire against my skin, the air filled with scents of lavender, beeswax, and ripe quince.
It's time.
Together we lifted our feet and stepped into the unknown. Chapter 43. The house was unnaturally quiet. For Sarah, it wasn't just the absence of chatter or the removal of seven active minds that made it seem so empty. It was not knowing. They'd come home earlier than usual from the Coven's gathering, claiming they needed to pack for Faye and Janet's road trip. Em had found the empty briefcase sitting by the family room couch, and Sarah had discovered the clothes, bundled up on top of the washing machine.
They're gone, Em had said.
Sarah went straight into her arms, her shoulders shaking.
Are they all right?
She'd whispered.
They're together, Em had replied.
It wasn't the answer Sarah wanted, but it was honest, just like Em. They'd thrown their own clothes into duffel bags, paying little attention to what they were doing. Now Tabitha and Em were already in the RV, and Faye and Janet were waiting patiently for Sarah to close up the house.
Sarah and the vampire had talked for hours in the still room on their last night in the house, sharing a bottle of red wine. Matthew had told her something of his past and shared his fears for the future. Sarah had listened, making an effort not to show her own shock and surprise at some of the tales he told. Though she was pagan, Sarah understood he wanted to make confession and had cast her in the role of priest. She had given him the absolution she could, knowing all the while that some deeds could never be forgiven or forgotten. But there was one secret he'd refused to share, and Sarah still knew nothing of where and when her niece had gone. The floorboards of the Bishop House creaked a chorus of groans and wheezes as Sarah walked through the familiar, darkened rooms. She closed the keeping room doors and turned to bid farewell to the only home she'd ever known. The keeping room doors opened with a sharp bang. One of the floorboards near the fireplace sprang up, revealing a small black-bound book and a creamy envelope. It was the brightest thing in the room, and it gleamed in the moonlight. Sarah muffled a cry and held out her hand. The cream square flew easily into it, landed with a slight smack, and flipped over. A single word was written on it. Sarah. She touched the letters lightly and saw Matthew's long white fingers. She tore at the paper, her heart beating fast. Sarah, it said. Don't worry. We made it. Her heart rate calmed. Sarah put the single sheet of paper on her mother's rocking chair and gestured for the book. Once the house delivered it, the floorboard returned to its normal resting place with the groan of old wood and the shriek of old nails. She flipped to the first page. The Shadow of Night, containing two poetical hymns devised by G.C. Gent, 1594. The book smelled old, but not unpleasant, like incense in a dusty cathedral. Just like Matthew, Sarah thought with a smile. A slip of paper stuck out of the top. It led her to the dedication page. To my dear and most worthy friend, Matthew Royden. Sarah peered more closely and saw a tiny, faded drawing of a hand with a ruffled cuff, pointing imperiously to the name, with the number 29 written underneath in ancient brown ink. She turned obediently to page 29, struggling through tears as she read the underlined passages. She hunters makes, and of that substance hounds, whose mouths deaf heaven, and furrow earth with wounds, and marvel not a nymph so rich in grace, to hounds, rude pursuits should be given in chase. For she could turn herself to every shape of swiftest beasts, and at her pleasure scape. The words conjured up the image of Diana, clear, bright, unbidden, her face framed with gauzy wings, and her throat thickly encircled with silver and diamonds. A single tear-shaped ruby quivered on her skin like a drop of blood, nestled into the notch between her collarbones. In the still room, as the sun was rising, he had promised to find some way to let her know Diana was safe. "Thank you, Matthew." Sarah kissed the book and the note and threw them into the cavernous fireplace. She said the words to conjure a white-hot fire. The paper caught quickly, and the book's edges began to curl. Sarah watched the fire burn for a few moments. Then she walked out the front door, leaving it unlocked, and didn't look back. Once the door closed, a worn silver coffin shot down the chimney and landed on the burning paper. Two gobbets of blood and mercury, released from the hollow chambers inside the ampulla by the heat of the fire, chased each other around the surface of the book, before falling into the grate. There they seeped into the soft old mortar of the fireplace and traveled into the heart of the house. When they reached it, the house sighed with relief and released a forgotten, forbidden scent. Sarah drank in the cool night air as she climbed into the RV. Her senses weren't sharp enough to catch the cinnamon and blackthorn, honeysuckle and chamomile dancing in the air.
"Okay?"
Em asked, her voice serene. Sarah leaned across the cat carrier that held Tabitha and squeezed Em's knee. "Just fine." Faye turned the key in the ignition and pulled down the driveway and onto the country road that would take them to the interstate, chattering about where they would stop for breakfast. The four witches were too far away to perceive the shift in atmosphere around the house, as hundreds of night creatures detected the unusual aroma of commingled vampire and witch, or to see the pale green smudges of the two ghosts in the keeping room window.
Bridget Bishop and Diana's grandmother watched the vehicle's departure.
"What will we do now?"
Diana's grandmother asked.
"What we've always done, Joanna," Bridget replied. "Remember the past and await the future."
This is Jennifer Iketa. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of A Discovery of Witches. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Claudia Howard. A Discovery of Witches is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA Incorporated and Recorded Books LLC. Copyright 2010, all rights reserved. The book, A Discovery of Witches, is available wherever G.P. Putnam's books are sold.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.